Thank you, Carrie. That is somewhat reminiscent of my story, which is similar but at the same time different. From a very young age, I decided that I wanted to be a journalist. And indeed, after graduating from college, I worked as a journalist, as a reporter and editor for 11 years. But toward the end, I started feeling this nudge toward pastoral ministry or something that I couldn't quite define as that. And I went kicking and screaming, at least at first, and fought long and hard with the Lord before finally realizing that this is what he wanted me to do. So each of our stories is different. But along those lines, I was really encouraged last week by Jeff Louie, our guest preacher, who told us that in the hierarchy of vocations, pastors occupy the highest place. Therefore, I am up here, and you all are down here, but maybe we could move Paul Taylor up here and Steve Zeisler and maybe a couple others. And that's exactly what Jeff Louie was telling us, right? Maybe I wasn't listening right, so that's an encouragement for you to listen to sermons, right? Especially this one. So 2 weeks ago, I was at the PBC picnic, and I had extended conversations with two individuals from PBC, both of whom, interestingly enough, told me that they loved their jobs. Now, when Jeff Louie was here with us last week, he cited a survey that indicated that 70% of Americans hate their jobs. So some people love their jobs, some people hate their jobs. And of course, in all this, we must remember that there are large numbers of people, not only in this country, but also around the world, who would love to hate their jobs because they don't have jobs and they need jobs. And sometimes we get thinking, we want to do all these things and we want our jobs to be meaningful, and that's all well and good, but we also must remember there are a lot of people in a different situation, and some of those are in this church. Well, throughout the summer, we have been looking at different aspects of our vocational lives. And for the final 2 weeks, what we want to do is this. We want to look at a story, the story of a worker, the story of Jacob, which is a fascinating story, especially as it ends up toward the end of his time in Haran when he is working for Laban. He is working for an exploitative tyrant. And from talking to some of you, I know that some of you work for people who might be just a little bit off. He works for an exploitative tyrant, and he works with backbiting co-workers. And yet somehow, especially at the end, he flourishes. He comes alive spiritually. So the question before us in the final 2 weeks is, can we also come alive spiritually in our vocations, especially perhaps in vocations that don't really float our boats all that much? So we will mostly be dealing with those kinds of questions next week in Genesis chapter 31, which grants us a great and wonderful overall perspective on everything that we've been talking about this summer. For now, this week, we're going to be in the last part of Genesis chapter 30, where we encounter Jacob, and in this story, six directives for us emerge, either directly or indirectly. So most of us, even if we have dream jobs, probably wish that there was something, at least something, that was different about our jobs. But is it possible that God doesn't want our jobs or our vocations to be different? Is it possible that through these difficulties in our vocations that he wants to make us different? Indeed, I think it is quite possible. Karen McCormick talked to us a few weeks ago about vocational disruptions, those things which come into our lives that make our vocations very difficult for a season. Jacob endures a 20-year vocational disruption. Now, there's quite a backstory here that we can't get into, but suffice it to say that Jacob is stuck. He managed to get himself enslaved to this tyrant by the name of Laban. He's in exile. He has moved from the promised land, the land of Canaan, to the land of Haran. He thought he was only going to be there for a little while, but it turns out that he ends up being stuck there for 20 years. So we're going to pick up the story in Genesis chapter 30, beginning at verse 25. And if you want to follow along, and if you're new to the Old Testament, Genesis is very easy to find. Why? First book. Can you count to 30? Easy. Turn to Genesis chapter 30. The text will also appear behind me. As soon as Rachel, that is, Jacob's wife, had borne Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own home and country." Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, that I may go, for you know the service that I have given to you. But Laban said to him, if I have found favor in your sight, I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you. Name your wages, and I will give it. Jacob said to him, you yourself know how I have served you and how your livestock has fared with me. For you had little before I came, and it has increased abundantly, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I turned. But now, when shall I provide for my own household also? He said, what shall I give you? Jacob said, you shall not give me anything. If you will do this for me, I will again pasture your flock and keep it. Let me pass through all your flock today, removing from it every speckled and spotted sheep and every black lamb and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and they shall be my wages. So my honesty will answer for me later when you come to look into my wages with you. Everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and black among the lambs, if found with me, shall be counted stolen. Laban said, good, let it be as you have said. But that day, Laban removed the male goats that were striped and spotted, and all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, even one that had white on it, and every lamb that was black, and put them in charge of his sons. And he set a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob pastured the rest of Laban's flock. So Jacob, at this point, wants to return home. He wants to go back to the promised land. And this is linked with his vow to make the Lord his God if the Lord would bring him back to the land. So this is a very significant development in Jacob's life. He has had a very checkered relationship with the Lord, but something has happened within him that he wants to move back to the promised land, which means he is moving toward the Lord. So we would see this as a positive development. Laban tells Jacob that he has discerned or learned by divination, a pagan practice, that the Lord has blessed him because of Jacob. It takes Laban a pagan practice to try to figure out what the truth is. Somehow he's figured out the truth, and the truth is that Jacob has blessed him. And we remember, if we are students of the book of Genesis, that God has entered into a covenant relationship with Jacob's family, beginning with Abraham. We call it the Abrahamic covenant, and this is a partnership in which the Lord joins with Abraham and his family to both relate to this family and also for this family to have a mission in the world, and that mission is to bless the nations. And so here we have Jacob being a blessing to Laban. So Jacob is able to say twice, essentially, to Laban, you know how I have served you. Your flocks have increased. I've been a faithful servant. All my work has been open to investigation. I am an honest worker. You know how I have served you. But Jacob has a concern. I mean, Laban has exploited him so that he can't even make a livable wage for him and his family, and his concern is to provide. When will I be able to provide for me and for my household? So Jacob comes up with an idea. He says, pay me this for wages. Pay me the abnormally colored among your flock. And this would be considered, there wouldn't be very many of these, so this would be considered less than standard wages for a shepherd. So Laban knows a good deal when he sees it, and he says, good, that's fine, let's do this. So Jacob has learned a few things along the way. He's learned a few things about the shepherding business, and now he wants to do a startup. He wants to start up this whole new flock and have a flock for his own. And so Laban agrees, but Laban, ever being the suspicious tyrant, separates the flocks out because he doesn't really trust Jacob. But this small number of abnormally colored animals still belongs to Jacob, even if they are being watched over by Laban's sons. So what emerges from this part of the story? Number one, work to benefit your employer. We are inheritors of the Abrahamic covenant. It is now called the New Covenant. What was promised to Abraham is now given to us in the New Covenant. And still, we are supposed to, in this covenant, relate to God, both individually and collectively, and also serve God's purposes in the world. So the covenant is both relational and it is missional. So therefore, we are to bless the nations. And one of the things we do is we, if we have jobs, whatever the vocation is, we bless our employers. We should be able to say, you know how I have served you. Everything I've done has been open to investigation. I've been a hard worker. I have nothing to hide. You know how I have served you. And our employers should be able to say, in so many words, the Lord has blessed me on account of you. Now, they're probably not going to use those kinds of words unless they're believers, but they're going to understand that we have served the company well. We have served the employer well. We've done our work well. We have been a blessing to the company. So this is what Paul says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 10 and 12. But we urge you, brothers, to do this more and more, and to aspire to live quietly, and to mind your own affairs, and to work with your hands as we instructed you, so that you may, and here's the key phrase here, so that you may walk properly before outsiders and be dependent on no one. So we want to work well and behave properly toward outsiders. And when we do this, we contribute to making the Lord visible in our vocations. Somehow, just doing your job, doing it well, that draws attention, and people might be drawn to the Lord because of it. No one should be able to say, she slacked off. No one should be able to say, he cut corners. No one should be able to say, she treated her coworkers poorly. So, first of all, work in order to benefit your employer. Second of all, work to provide. Jacob was very much concerned with providing for his family. The simplest biblical reason for going to work and for earning a livable wage is to provide for you and your family. We make it more esoteric than that around here, and I think that's well and good that we do. We want to think about all of these things, but let us not lose sight of the fact that the simplest and purest biblical reason for going to work is to earn money to provide for you and for your family. And this is what Paul says also, 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 12. Now such persons we command and encourage in the Lord Jesus Christ to do their work quietly and to earn their own living. And then he says in 1 Timothy 5, 8, but if anyone does not provide for his relatives and especially for members of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So if you hate your job, but you earn a livable wage, give thanks, because a livable wage is not to be taken for granted. Earlier this year, I went to India with our missions team, and we went with Operation Mobilization, and they took us around to a few different things that they are doing, and one of the places they took us to was a school on the edge of a village, which is providing an education for kids who wouldn't have an opportunity to learn otherwise. And so at one particular point, I was on the edge of this school field, and I was looking across out in the distance, and the next field over there, there was a kiln, and there were workers in this kiln, and I saw this one woman, and she was working at the kiln, and near as I could tell, her job was simply to carry bricks from one place to another. And she did it by stacking six bricks on one side of her head and six bricks on the other side of her head. And one of our team members also noticed her and took a picture. Here she is. And then you can see that's where she gathered the bricks, and there's steps over there. She would walk up to the steps and deposit the bricks over there and then walk back, and she would do this, near as I could tell, all day. And as I was watching her, one of the operatives from Operation Mobilization, one of our hosts for our trip, came up to me and informed me a little bit more about this woman and women like her. He says that she earns $2 a day. She works all day, every day. On this particular day, it's 80 degrees. In a few weeks, it's going to be 100 degrees. Not much shade out there. There's no family planning in the villages. So if she hasn't already, she's going to have a baby probably pretty soon. And when she does, what's she going to do? One day she's going to have the baby. The next day she's going to strap that baby on her back and she's going to go to work. All day, every day, back and forth, carrying bricks with a baby on her back. That's what he told me. Now, I don't know if she would resonate with some of the things we've been talking about this summer, but my guess is that at the very top of the list, that her number one priority for doing this is to provide for her and her family. Work to provide. Next, work to develop skills. Jacob worked as a shepherd for a long time, and he learned a lot of things about the sheep and the goat business. And what he learned really prepared him for the future in so many ways, in ways that he couldn't have imagined. Jacob was a shepherd, but he was being called to be the shepherd of the most important family in the history of the world. That is the family of Abraham. So by learning to care for sheep and goats, he was learning how to care for people. He was learning how to shepherd people. He was learning how to shepherd a family. He was learning how to be a spiritual shepherd. He didn't know that's what was happening. Moses didn't know that was happening either when he was being a shepherd out in the wilderness. David didn't know that was happening. But the Lord was using all of this experience they had in order to prepare them to be shepherds of God's people. You never know how God is preparing you. Therefore, learn skills wherever you are. Just learn. Soak it all up. Learn as much as you can. You might think, this has nothing to do with what I'm doing now. It might have very much to do with what God has for you later. Therefore, learn skills in your vocation. Jacob wasn't given much in the way of wages, but he was given an opportunity, and he learned from that opportunity. A few years ago, I watched a documentary about a man who was a failure at everything he had done by the age of 33. Then World War I broke out, and he decided he was going to enlist, but he was partially blind in one eye. So in order to pass the eye exam, he memorized the chart. He rose to the level of captain. He was put in charge of these troops in Europe. He led his troops into battle, and they said that luck just seemed to follow him around. He led his troops into battle, and he never lost a man. He came home, he opened up a men's clothing store, and it failed, and he went bankrupt. He was 38 years old. Then one of his war buddies said, because of his war record, he might make a pretty good political candidate. So he decided to run for county commissioner, and he won. But he just barely won. He won by 279 votes. The man's name? Harry S. Truman, 33rd president of the United States. And in the face of failure, he learned all sorts of things. He continued to work hard, and he had no idea that all of those things that he was learning, all of those things were preparing him to be a particular man at a particular place to bless an entire nation in its hour of need. So, what about all of these abnormally colored livestock? What about them? Genesis chapter 30, verse 37. Then Jacob took fresh sticks of poplar and almond and plane trees and peeled white streaks in them, exposing the white of the sticks. He set the sticks that he had peeled in front of the flocks and the troughs, that is, the watering places where the flocks came to drink. And since they bred when they came to drink, the flocks bred in front of the sticks, and so the flocks brought forth striped, speckled, and spotted. And Jacob separated the lambs and set the faces of the flocks toward the striped, and all the black in the flock of Laban. He put his own droves apart and did not put them with Laban's flock. Whenever the stronger of the flock were breeding, Jacob would lay the sticks in the troughs before the eyes of the flock, that they might breed among the sticks. But for the feebler of the flock, he would not lay them there. So the feebler would be Laban's, and the stronger Jacob's. Thus the man increased greatly and had large flocks, female servants and male servants, and camels and donkeys. So do you understand what's going on here? No, yeah, neither do I. Which is probably no great comfort to you because this guy's supposed to know what he's talking about. But I understand a little bit because I read ahead. I read ahead to Genesis chapter 31, where we find that the Lord has given Jacob a dream and the Lord has been involved in all of this. So on the one hand, his breeding technique apparently represents the idea that if these animals are facing something multicolored while they are breeding, that they are going to bring forth multicolored young. That's what it looks like. On the other hand, we learn from Genesis 31 that Jacob's flock has increased, and it is all the Lord's doing, especially because of this dream that the Lord has given to Jacob. So the Lord is responsible for what's going on here. And what Jacob is able to do then is to have a flock of his own that is growing, a flock of his own of strong animals and abnormally colored animals. So this reminds me of the cheer for Northwestern University several years ago when they weren't a very good team. Northwestern would go through an entire season without winning a game. Maybe they would win one or two games. And so the cheering squad had to figure out, how do you cheer for a team like that? You can't really cheer when they score because they never score. So they came up with this cheer to cheer when the other team scored. And it went like this. That's all right. That's okay. They're going to work for us someday. Creative, right? That reminds me of what's going on here. What Jacob has been able to do is to turn the tables on Laban the tyrant. And he's able to be successful. Now, it has taken Jacob many years, 20 years in fact, but finally he is a wealthy man. So, what do we learn from this part of the story? Number one, be creative. Be creative. Now, if you have some difficult circumstances within your vocations, and if there are oppressive circumstances, you might think, how can I be creative? I could be really creative if people would get off my back, if my coworkers would leave me alone, if my boss weren't breathing down my throat all the time. I could be really creative. You should see the code that I would be able to write then. You should see the magnificent stuff that I would be able to come up with on such occasions. But notice, Jacob was in the middle of oppressive circumstances, and he became very creative. Oftentimes, it is the oppressive circumstances that motivates us to be creative. Many of us don't even start thinking outside the box until everything inside the box doesn't work. So oftentimes, then, it's very much true that the oppressive circumstances motivate us actually to be creative. It's no excuse not to be creative. So you might think it's easy to get up here and preach a sermon, you open up a text, you read a few words, you spout off a few words, but let me assure you that it takes a little bit of work. Let me assure you that times I feel a sense of darkness. Sometimes starting out, I look at a text and I say, nothing's going to come of this. I know it's the Word of God, but there's nothing here. But if I stick with it and if I pray and if I make my way through, sometimes the synapses start firing and I start seeing a few things. And then I try to think about, how does this all work into a sermon? How do you craft a sermon out of this? And this is completely incoherent. This is not going to make sense at all. I'm going to completely confuse those people out there. And again, there's these dark thoughts that come in. And then sometimes I just have writer's block and I can't make my way forward. But if I pray, if I trust the Lord, if I stick with it, or if I drop it for a while and step away from it, sometimes things come to me. I don't know why, but when I go to the gym, I'm not thinking about the text at all. I'm not thinking about the sermon at all. I'm working on the elliptical trainer, and boom, wow, that makes all this, that solves this interpretive problem. Oh, this is going to go here in the sermon, and that's going to make all the sense in the world. I never would have seen it. And so the difficulties of the text, sometimes then when I come to particularly difficult texts, I get excited and I get invigorated, go, what is God going to show me in this? What am I going to see here that's going to really bless me, and I hope and pray bless you as well? So, Be creative. We are made in the image of God. That is something that we say often. What does that mean? At the very least, it means this: we are somewhat like God. But it also means especially this: we are His representative rulers on this earth. That's what we understand from the context of Genesis chapter 1. But speaking of the context of Genesis chapter 1, when God tells us that He has made us in His image, what has He been doing all along in Genesis chapter 1? Creating. He's the creator. He made us to be creators. We don't create something out of nothing the way He did, although sometimes it seems that way. When you're looking at nothing on the landscape and you think nothing's going to emerge, and suddenly something emerges. Be creative. Next, be wary of riches. Jacob became wealthy, it is true, but it took him years. That's in contrast to what many people around here think. They want to get rich quick. They want to have, some people anyway, want to start a startup, and they want that thing to go public within 6 months or a year or something like that, and they're going to hit the jackpot. And people come from all over the world to do that. This is like the new gold rush. And people want to get rich, and they want to get rich quick. But too much money and too much success too soon is not usually good for the soul. It goes to the head. It makes people think that they're invincible. It makes people think that they can conquer the world. It makes people think that they don't need God. Adam Gopnik of The New Yorker says this: as incomes go up, steeples come down. And I wonder if that's what's happening in the Silicon Valley. There used to be, years ago, a lot more people around here who were interested in the things of God. They would go to church. They would go to Bible studies. They would pray. They would open up the scriptures. Percentage-wise, this is one of the least churched areas in the whole country. And I wonder why. I wonder if part of the reason is it's such a wealthy area for so many people, and that money has taken them away from their spiritual thirst for God. Jesus says this, Luke 16, verse 13, "No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." I was taken aback a while back when I was reading Paul E. Miller's book, A Praying Life, and he said this: "I broke out into a cold sweat when one of my kids was considering a career that would make him wealthy. And I thought to myself, I have two kids. I hope they have successful careers. I would like them very much to be wealthy." And then he said this: "There is absolutely nothing wrong with earning a lot of money. I'm just keenly aware of what wealth can do to your soul." Now, this needs to be said in the church, because there are false teachers in the church, not this one, but there are false teachers in the church and on the airwaves and on the internet who are preaching very convincingly to some people that Jesus wants all His followers to be rich. And people are believing those men and women, and people are giving money to those men and women. So we must say that Jesus does not want all His followers to be rich. He might want some of you to be rich. He might want some of you to be poor, but what He wants is for you, whether you are rich or poor, to meet with Him and to know Him and to be saved and to follow Him and to be a blessing to the world. Now, as Miller observes, there is nothing wrong with making a lot of money, but what do you do with that money? Final point, be generous. Be generous. This is one of the reasons for actually working hard, is so that we can be generous. Listen to what Paul says to the Ephesian elders in Acts 20, verse 35. "In all things, I have shown you that by working hard in this way, we must help the weak and remember the words of the Lord Jesus, how He Himself said, 'It is more blessed to give than to receive.'" Work hard in order to do what here? Help the weak. Be generous. As noted, the Silicon Valley is one of the wealthiest places on earth, but it is also one of the least philanthropic. In a recent survey, we came out, the Silicon Valley ranked number 48 out of 50 in terms of metropolitan areas throughout the whole country. So here we are, one of the wealthiest places, but we're also one of the stingiest places. Let us, as followers of Jesus, be countercultural. And when you think about being generous, the place to start is with God himself. God himself, of course, is generous, extraordinarily generous. He has been generous to you. And if you can open your heart to that, generosity is naturally going to flow from that. And also, you must remember that everything you have, every cent that you have earned, all of your possessions, all of it comes from God, and all of it belongs to God. And you offer it back to God, and you say, here it is. Here's my life. Here's everything in my life. It's yours. What do you want me to do with it? Jacob's heart began to move toward the Lord. It began to move home. It began to move toward the promised land. And the promised land in the Hebrew scriptures is called the inheritance of the people of God. We too have an inheritance, and that is the new creation. It is coming, friends. It is the new heavens and the new earth. It is the new creation, which is our inheritance. And that is going to be an eternal inheritance. And the Apostle John has this beautiful, enormous, magnificent vision of it in Genesis chapter 21 and 22. And at the end of that vision, in Genesis chapter 22, he says that we, as the servants of the Lord, will worship him or serve him or work for him. And in the very next sentence, John says this, we will see his face. We will work for Jesus and we will see his face. Can you imagine, just for a moment, just seeing the face of Jesus, your Lord and your Savior? Sometimes I just think about it. Sometimes I just try to picture myself looking at Jesus face to face. And when you see him, when you see that, just that absolute pure love, looking right into your eyes, and it's going to go right into your soul, what are you going to say? I think one of the things you'll say is this, I'll do anything for you. You name it, I'll do anything for you. And then he's going to give you something to do. And when he does, you'll understand that it's going to be fully meaningful and perfectly suited to who you are, to who he created you to be, and to who he redeemed you to be. I have this perspective when I go on mission trips, and I don't know if it's right, but this is how I trick myself a little bit. When I'm going on these mission trips, of course, I'm thinking about the gospel. I'm going for the sake of the gospel. I'm going for the sake of these wonderful, needy people or pastors or whoever who need the gospel who need the scriptures. I'm going for them, and that motivates me. But I know that I'm going to encounter some sorts of difficulty. I'm not going to sleep very well, or usually I don't. I'm more likely to get sick. I'm going to have these cultural misunderstandings and all sorts of difficulties, and it's not going to be probably all that significant, although to a certain extent, when you go to some of these places, you're risking your life, but I've never felt threatened. Nevertheless, it is a little bit of a sacrifice, and I tell myself, well, it's only 2 weeks. I'm coming home in 2 weeks. This is not for the rest of my life. I can take anything for 2 weeks. And again, I'm not sure if it's right that I think this, but this is what I think. So, if you're in some sort of vocation that's difficult for you, if the conditions are miserable, even oppressive, here's what you need to know. It's only for a little while. It's only for 20 years, in Jacob's case. Or it's only for 100 years. And 100 years, in light of eternity, is a blink of the eye. It's only for a little while. And when you see the face of Jesus, wait until the work that he has for you. And I can promise you this, you're going to love your job.